From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Voters in Ireland are at the polls today, deciding whether that country will become the first nation ever to legalize same-sex marriage by popular vote.
A big deal for a country with a population that is 84% Catholic and has a long history of social conservatism. The polls close tonight. Results expected tomorrow. Let's bring in Martina Fitzgerald, political correspondent for the Irish broadcaster RTE News. She's with us from Dublin. Martina, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, what's the turnout been like so far today?
Well, all the indications are so far that it's going to be higher than our last referendum. Now, the last referendum or national vote we had, it was to get rid of our second chamber, our second parliament, which was the Seanad, or Senate, as you would call it. And turnout at that point was 39% at the end of the day, which was quite low. But this time around, all the indications are that it's going to be much higher than that. And we have scenes in the airports of people coming back, especially to vote, people coming back from America, from Canada, and also at the ferries today, people were interviewed coming back from England. So all indications are that more young people in particular are coming out to vote on this occasion.
And does that lead you to believe that this is going to pass?
Well, what we can say is that three academics here have done a study of all these national votes that we've had over the years. And where the turnout is lower, there is an increased likelihood of a no vote. So by implication, a higher turnout, it would favour the yes side.
And if that happens, it would be quite a change from just 20 years ago when homosexuality was decriminalized in Ireland. That happened in 1993. I guess it was 22 years ago. But what a change in public opinion that would be.
That's right. And civil partnership was introduced here in 2010. Also, you have to remember that divorce was narrowly accepted here just in 1995 by 9,000 votes. So it would be, if it turns out to be the case, if it's passed, it would be a major landmark decision.
Why do these things all have to be decided by referendum in Ireland?
Well, I suppose it's built into our constitution and they can't change that unless it's by vote of the people. And I suppose that's what this is all about and why this campaign has been so emotive, that this has to be done by the people and that they have constitutional protections for marriage at the moment as opposed to just legal protections. And so that's why we have had a very long and a very emotive campaign on this issue. And obviously it's nearing its end. We should know about local time here at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock tea time tomorrow afternoon.
How much of a role has the Catholic Church played in all of this?
Numerous bishops have come out and have expressed concern about the referendum and obviously what has been posed to the people, and they've been coming out quite a lot and quite regularly. And they're, I suppose, on the no side, people who are opposed to this are concerned about the redefinition of marriage, and some others are concerned what impact it will have on the definition of family and family rights. So that has been a big feature of this campaign. But it has to be said, no one has ownership of the issue of family or children in this campaign, because on the yes side, you're just as likely to have a parent of a gay person come out and talk as you have a parent who's opposed to it. Like we had our former president, Mary McAleese, whose son is gay, articulate why she believes this should be passed, which is quite unusual.
Well, and you also had the Prime Minister, Enda Kenny, has urged a yes vote. Are people paying attention to the high-profile names that are coming out in support, or is this more of a personal decision for people in Ireland?
Well, a lot of high-profile people have come out not just to vote yes, but have come out as gay during this campaign. Leo Varadkar, our Minister for Health, came out as gay. We had a political correspondent from another station come out as gay. We had a junior minister, Pat Gehry, come out as gay. It's been a big feature of these personal contributions. All the main political parties are now in favour of this. But, and there is a but, back in the children's referendum on children's rights a few years ago, all the main political parties were in favour of it, but still 40% voted no. And traditionally, in these national votes, you get almost 30% voting no.
That's Martina Fitzgerald, a political correspondent for the Irish broadcaster RTE News, speaking to us as the people of Ireland go to the polls today to vote on the issue of same-sex marriage. Martina, thank you.
And thank you.
Let's turn now to Colorado, where a successful program to reduce teen pregnancy is in jeopardy. Last month, the state legislature voted down funding for the Colorado Family Planning Initiative. The program was aimed at teens and low-income residents, and it expanded access to hormonal implants and IUDs, so-called long-acting reversible contraceptives. And after 6 years, the results were significant. Teen pregnancy and abortions dropped in Colorado, which saved the state almost $80 million in Medicaid funding. But as we said, the program's future is uncertain. Larry Woke is Executive Director and Chief Medical Officer at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, the agency that oversees the initiative, and he joins us now from Denver. Dr. Woke, tell us in a little more detail just how effective has the program been?
The program's been impressively and incredibly successful. We've seen more than a 40% decrease in the number of unintended pregnancies and the outcomes related to unintended pregnancies. We've seen significant decreases in abortions. We've seen significant decreases in births. We've seen significant decreases in the downstream costs and effects because there are fewer pregnant women and fewer children living in poverty who need to be signed up for public entitlement programs like Medicaid or WIC for formula assistance. And so across the board, this has been a remarkable success story.
So a remarkable success story in that it has reduced teen pregnancies. It has saved the state of Colorado a significant amount of money. And yet, the Colorado State Legislature has voted against funding this program. It was initially funded by a private grant from a foundation, but the legislature has chosen not to continue the program. I mean, one of the reasons why we're seeing is that some legislators have said, hey, this program is actually redundant, that some of these contraceptive devices are more affordable and accessible than ever, and that federal funding should already cover them. So what do you say to that?
Well, the first thing I say is the private funding that we had received really was key and critical, but supplemental because there are other funding sources for the LARC, the long-acting reversible contraceptives, including insurance payments, both public and private, and more so, at least theoretically, as a result of the Affordable Care Act. The problem is the reality is that you know, these patients, these people, they walk into the clinics and they may not have insurance at that time, or their insurance might say that it covers LARC, but in fact, it doesn't cover it or it doesn't reimburse the providers adequately. And the other thing that we find is that a lot of providers aren't trained. Primary care providers, like myself as a pediatrician, aren't necessarily trained up to date on how to insert an IUD or implantable contraceptives. And so there's a training component to this funding that's pretty significant. So yes, things are changing. There is more coverage available, but there are still a lot of gaps, and we need either state funding or private funding to fill those gaps.
Now, this program was the subject of intense debate in the Colorado legislature because, you know, beyond the redundancy and the funding issue, what underlied some objection to the program was the question of abortion. Because while we're talking about contraceptive devices, specifically with those IUDs, there were some legislators who said that there are cases in which, you know, the IUD doesn't prevent an egg and sperm from joining, but it does prevent implantation. So, I mean, I'm seeing here that, for example, Senator Kevin Lundberg called IUD, quote, devices that are used to prevent the birth of a live baby and therefore shouldn't be funded by taxpayers. So what's your response to that concern?
Well, I'm a clinician, and that sort of criticism has no clinical merit. It's strictly a political critique. You know, my goal is to keep people focused on the clinical merits of the program. So frustrating for me as a clinician that there were searches for political messages to try and then successfully take away the opportunity to provide public funding for this program.
Right. I mean, as you note, while there may have been political reasons for it, it has led to the very real conclusion of this program not getting any additional funding from the state of Colorado. So what is going to happen now that the funding's run out?
Gratefully, we've had an outpouring of support from many private foundations and funders throughout the state, as well as even from out of state. And so we're convening a group next week to discuss how we continue to sustain such a successful program. We still receive both state and federal money, as well as insurance money, to help sustain these programs for practices and providers. And so, you know, with some tweaking, I think we can work with these foundations, we can work with the insurance companies, and we'll continue to work with both state and federal government, because part of the success of this program is the diversified funding approach to sustain it, rather than be solely reliant on a single private funder or state funding.
Well, Dr. Larry Woke is Executive Director and Chief Medical Officer at the Colorado Department of Public Health and the Environment. Dr. Woke, thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
The question everyone wants answered is how a cold-blooded murderer ever got out in the first place. That question was posed by a newspaper in 1987 in the wake of a horrible crime in Baltimore. Just 1 year later, the entire nation was asking the same question because of this 30-second television ad.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
The Willie Horton weekend passes ad changed the 1988 presidential race. Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis had a strong lead over Vice President George H.W. Bush before the ad aired. But of course, Dukakis lost the race. And politicians say the ad shaped how they talked about crime for a generation, to the point where Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois says the ghost of Willie Horton has loomed over any conversation about sentencing reform for almost 30 years. But now the nation is gearing up for another presidential election, and the way candidates talk about crime has, in fact, changed. So has the Horton ghost been purged from American politics? Beth Schwartz-Apfel asks that question in her piece, Willie Horton Revisited. It's featured by the Marshall Project, a nonpartisan news organization focusing on criminal justice. Beth, welcome. And let's first start with just how important the Willie Horton ad was in that 88 race. I mean, Lee Atwater, who was George H.W. Bush's strategist, he famously said that they were going to talk about Horton so much voters would think he was Dukakis's running mate. And Atwater also said that it was an important gut issue at the time. So what did he mean by that?
Lee Atwater claimed that Willie Horton's race didn't matter at all. And in fact, in our story, there's a clip of him saying, I don't think most people in the South even know what race Willie Horton is, which seems to be pretty patently false. You know, he was...
Well, the ad had his picture in it.
Of course it did. Yeah. And in fact, there was also a picture of this white guard sort of leading him by the arm. And Horton's tall. He's taller than 6 feet. And he's sort of towering over this white guy and sort of looking down at him. But, you know, I think if you had asked Atwater, he would have said, well, any murderer is going to be scary. He just happens to be black. But when he uses terms like gut issues and values issues, he sort of reveals what's going on underneath.
And so how did that then dovetail with voters' attitudes about crime and criminal justice itself in the mid to late 80s?
It's hard to remember now because crime rates are so low. They're at historic lows, and they have been now for years. But the 80s were a very violent time, and people were scared. And I think there was a certain level of panic going on in the electorate, and people were just looking for politicians who promised to crack down on criminals.
It's so interesting to think back to that time because we're going to talk more in a minute about how attitudes have changed. But even at that time, I mean, the Bush campaign knew that they had a very explosive issue on their their hands. I mean, insofar as it was talking about race, I'm talking about crime and race, as we touched upon. And in fact, you know, the media sort of amplified all of this. Mm-hmm. The ad itself only ran for like a month, mm-hmm. right?
In a very limited media market, too.
Yeah. So we've got some tape here more of how Lee Atwater dealt with questions from the media about whether or not the ad was racist, and whether or not the ad actually came from the Bush campaign, because while they were talking about it, they were also trying to distance themselves from it. So here's Lee Atwater being questioned by Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes.
You think the Willie Horton commercial, though, gives hints of racial politics?
I haven't seen the Willie Horton commercial.
You don't have a Willie Horton commercial on the air?
No.
A furlough program commercial? Mm-hmm. You don't have a crime? You don't have an ad on the air about the crime issue?
Mm-mm.
Yet on the other hand, you also report that the Bush campaign had Horton's mugshot hanging up at their campaign headquarters.
It does strain credulity that the Bush campaign knew nothing about this ad. You know, I think you see a lot of this kind of political gymnastics even now, with PACs being seemingly independent when, you know, really there's obviously links between the PAC and the campaign.
What really is interesting about this is that you also spoke with Governor Dukakis. And he told you, essentially, he doesn't actually blame Horton himself.
I mean, I blame myself. I mean, there was no reason under the sun why I shouldn't have been able to deal effectively with this. It turned out it was one of the dumbest decisions I ever made. I made a decision early in the campaign that I was not going to respond to the Bush attack campaign.
I mean, what could he have done, though, at the time? There seemed to be, like, this juggernaut of emotional power behind what the Bush campaign was doing.
Well, what he told us was he could have produced a very similar ad because, you know, the federal program and the program in California under then-Governor Reagan both had very similar stories of people who were furloughed and then went on to commit another crime. He knew about several that had happened under Bush's watch when he was vice president in the federal system.
But now we're getting, you know, back into what is a very important legal backdrop here and, you know, questions about how this ad not only changed presidential politics, but the criminal justice system. In 1987, 10% of state and federal prisoners actually received furlough. But after Willie Horton, after the ad, what happened around the country regarding the furlough program?
Furloughs are almost unheard of now. Occasionally, states will run a very small furlough program, but they'll do it very under the radar. You know, they don't want any press for obvious reasons, because as soon as the public hears about it, they freak out and the program gets shut down.
How much of it was because of what happened to Michael Dukakis in that campaign?
It's really hard to say. I think that there's a little bit of a chicken and egg question. You know, the public was already sort of panicking about crime during this period. So I think simultaneously the ad tapped into a pre-existing amount of anxiety around crime. At the same time, it sort of mobilized that anxiety, gave it a name, you know, set it in motion. So it's hard to say how much is attributable to the ad and how much the ad just really very accurately captured the public sentiment at that time.
So this all, again, it's chicken and egg. I take your point. And here we are almost three decades later. And there are many people saying, and I think legitimately so, that the way politicians talk today about the criminal justice system has changed quite dramatically. So first, here's President Obama in the State of the Union address talking about mass incarceration.
Surely we can agree that it's a good thing that for the first time in 40 years, the crime rate and the incarceration rate have come down together, and use that as a starting point for Democrats and Republicans, community leaders and law enforcement, to reform America's criminal justice system so that it protects and serves all of us.
All right, so that was President Obama in January of this year. Here's Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul, who is running for president, speaking about another aspect of the criminal justice system, about fines and penalties, which can then lead many people to be forced to go to prison. He was speaking at Bowie State University in Maryland in March.
Those of us who have jobs and who have lived fairly privileged lives don't know what it's like to have to pay fines and then pay penalties on top of fines, and how someone's life can spiral out of control because of this.
And finally, here's Hillary Clinton, Democratic presidential candidate, speaking just last month.
If the United States brought our correctional expenditures back in line with where they were several decades ago, we'd save an estimated $28 billion a year, and I believe we would not be less safe. It's time to change our approach. It's time to end the era of mass incarceration.
So Beth Schwartz-Apfel, I mean, it does seem as if the power of crime as an issue in presidential politics is quite different now than it was in 1988.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it used to be that crime was at the top of the list when, you know, these polling organizations would ask voters, what do you care most about in the election? It would always be in the top three. In the last election, you know, Gallup asked voters what they care most about, and they didn't even include crime on the list of things that they wanted voters to rank. So it's just lost its power as a political issue to a certain extent.
But, you know, when it comes to the potency of crime as an issue in elections, I mean, in your reporting, it seems as if it's still there, though, because you have several examples of how frightening criminals have been used in close races.
The interesting thing is actually in almost every election, you see somebody try it. But what has started to happen is actually it stops working. And sometimes it even backfires.
Well, I want to play one last piece of tape from Governor Dukakis himself, because I think he kind of disagrees with you.
No, there's any question about it. You get one of these horrendous cases, and all hell breaks loose.
I mean, that's Governor Dukakis saying that he doesn't actually think much has changed. A close race, maybe a battleground state, one really bad, awful case, and it could go back to 1988.
One can never predict the future. I mean, sure, you just don't know. But, you know, if recent history is any guide, you know, you just don't see these kind of ads getting the traction that they used to get. Even in Alaska, Mark Begich, who was the incumbent, ran this very inflammatory ad trying to tie his opponent to the release of this sex offender who then went on to commit another horrible crime. And in fact, the victims in that case wrote to Begich and said, take the ad down. You're offending us. And in fact, Begich lost the race. And people think that it was in large part because of the pushback he got from that ad. So it actually was backlash in that case.
Well, we'll see how this plays out in the presidential race as we head into 2016. Beth Schwartz-Apfel is a staff writer for the Marshall Project. It's a nonprofit news organization that covers the criminal justice system. Her piece, written along with Bill Keller, is called Revisiting Willie Horton. Beth, thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for this great reporting.
Thanks for having me.
If you've seen the historic flooding in Texas this week, you may wonder, what's causing this? Well, some are looking at El Nino, which is back in the Pacific. Forecasters first declared that in early March, but it may be strengthening. Mike Halpert is deputy director of NOAA's Climate Prediction Center. He's with us from College Park, Maryland. And Mike, is what's happening in Texas attributable to El Nino?
You know, the signal for El Nino is typically not particularly strong in the spring and in the summer, although part of that is because typically we don't see El Nino conditions at this time of year, so that's a little unusual in and of itself. There's potentially some link to El Nino with the rains in Texas and even some of the rains we saw in California a few weeks ago. But again, it's not really the hallmark of an El Nino.
Now, this is a weak to moderate El Nino at this point. Is it likely to strengthen as the year goes on?
You know, that's kind of the really important question. You know, we do anticipate some strengthening over the next couple of months. The real interesting and important question is whether this becomes a strong or even very strong event as we head into next winter.
But I guess one of the big questions is if it does strengthen or even if it stays as a weak to moderate El Nino, is it going to bring rain and moisture to California, which is in such need of it?
You know, weak to moderate events have weaker impacts in California. Oftentimes we do see some beneficial rains in the southern part of the state, but of course really the drought extends over much of the state. And from what we've seen in the historical record, what we really need is the strong events to really tilt the odds towards wet up and down California. You know, over the past 60 years, we've seen roughly six strong events, and at least in five of those, we've seen well above normal rainfall and snowfall. So, you know, the weak to moderate, maybe not so much a big story. You know, if it does become strong or even one of the real strong ones, you know, that's when folks can maybe start to get a bit excited.
I'm looking at a blog post about this that talks about some of the possible effects. And they all look pretty good. More rain in California, fewer hurricanes in the Atlantic, a milder winter for much of the U.S., fewer tornadoes. The only one that looks kind of troubling is that there would be perhaps a more active Pacific typhoon season. Is there anything we're forgetting about that El Nino brings?
You raise an interesting point, which namely is that El Nino is oftentimes a positive for the United States. You know, it seems like a lot of people kind of like they run screaming
They're
for the
scared
hills
of El
when
Nino.
They hear El Nino's coming. Exactly. Sometimes the rains can be too much in California, and so then you're dealing with all kinds of flooding and landslides. You know, given the four-year drought that's ongoing right now, I think maybe they would suffer through some flooding to have some beneficial rains. One thing to add, though, is that the drought is so entrenched right now in California that I suspect even a really good next winter is still not going to wipe out this drought.
That's Mike Halpert, who's the deputy director of NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, as we wait to see what kind of El Nino it's going to be this year. Mike, thank you.
You're very welcome.
How do you go from respected history of science scholar to best-selling author? Well, if you're Deborah Harkness, you make one of your leading characters a science historian, and then you add vampires. Harkness's All Souls trilogy was a huge hit. The third and final novel, The Book of Life, is out in paperback this week. Now, the series began in 2011, where we meet the trilogy's main character, Diana Bishop. She's a witch and a professor. She discovers a mysterious manuscript which promptly vanishes, so Bishop sets out to look for it with the help of Matthew Claremont, scientist and 1,500-year-old vampire. We spoke to Deborah Harkness about The Book of Life last July, and she told us about the inspiration for the series, which was this question: imagine vampires really did exist. What's their job?
As a historian of science, I study how people in the past came up with stories about the world and how it worked and their place in it. And I was traveling in Mexico and went through an airport bookstore, and I suddenly looked up and there was a wall full of books about vampires, witches, demons, shapeshifters, you name it. And I looked at that wall and I thought, if there really are all those creatures, what on earth do they do for a living? I guess the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, I love that you asked what seems to be such a straightforward and practical question, what do they do for a living? But on the other hand, through your lens as a historian, what people do for a living like really unlocks their histories and their cultures, does it not?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a huge part of what we do. So being able to really figure out, you know, if you were a vampire and you had a lot of time on your hands, what would you choose to do with that time? And I thought, well, anything that has a long-term return. So I was thinking, you know, investment of money, art connoisseurship, science, all of those things would be great options for somebody who knew that they had centuries.
And in the case of the main vampire in your series, Matthew, not only does he have centuries, I mean, he has millennia. He's, what, 1,500 years old?
Yeah, I'm a historian. There was not going to be any 70-year-old vampires, anything like that. I was going to have a serious vampire.
And he's a scientist, too.
He is a scientist. So again, as a historian of science, I really very deliberately selected his time of rebirth as a vampire. It was a period in European history where language, literature was not often studied. There were no universities. And so I tried to imagine a kind of trajectory that someone would take who was interested in the same kind of questions I am. You know, how does the world work? What is my place in it? Which are the basic questions of science? And then to follow his development through not just 50 years, but 1,500 years. And it was so much fun.
Suddenly it occurs to me, I mean, your area of expertise is in Elizabethan England. Was there or is there anything about that particular place and time in history that you think really lends itself to these kind of thought experiments, which are so beautifully rendered in your trilogy?
I think it's a period when a lot of the things people thought they knew about the world and how it worked were starting to crumble and crumble pretty rapidly, but there weren't yet great explanations that would replace them. So the Elizabethan England is the period, it's right on the heels of the Copernican Revolution. Mm-hmm. So the universe had literally just been reorganized and turned inside out. There was attempts made to reform the calendar. 10 whole days were stripped out of a year because the astronomical data and the calendar making had gotten out of sync at a time. People were just beginning to develop trigonometry, and calculus would come in another sort of 60 years. But really, it's another 100 years until Newton. So the medieval worldview is crumbling. The modern worldview is not yet in place. And so it was in a time of enormous possibility and play, when magic and science really were very equal players on the stage in terms of what will give us answers. And that's what really fascinates me, because we think of magic and science as being quite diametrically opposed. In the period that I study, they're actually quite close together.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about Diana. She's the central character in the trilogy. She's a witch, but has this very complicated relationship with her own power. And much of her journey through these three books basically is her coming to terms with this supernatural prowess that she has. Why did you decide to approach her character in that way?
Being a witch has not ever really been a great thing in culture.
Uh-huh.
Whether Eastern, Western, ancient, medieval, modern, being labeled a witch is problematic for women. And yet, most popular literature today makes it into something that is unproblematic, that should be eagerly embraced, that you can just sort of accept with eagerness and gusto. You are magically blessed. You got your ticket to Hogwarts and off you go. And I really wanted to explore why someone might not want that kind of a legacy. And in part, it was inspired by my teaching. I see enormously talented women in my classes, women who are brilliant, who have so much to offer for the world, and who are, in a way, kind of desperately trying to hide that because they don't want to stand out too much. And so I really wanted to write a story of a woman who grew into her power and came to accept her power and didn't just sort of, you know, take it up and start casually wielding thunderbolts in every direction, like without a care in the world, because that just doesn't seem to me to reflect what I see when I walk into my classroom.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to explore that a bit more.
I think that's one of the reasons why so many people have loved your book so much, because through these characters, they present the perfect vehicle to really talk about the duality of individual and cultural struggles. I mean, we see that in so many ways, even in Matthew, because, of course, he's very dashing.
Absolutely.
He's rich and he's handsome. He's a little overprotective.
He has an anger management
problem. Yeah, I mean, he at the same time, he's, to put it bluntly, he's a killer.
Yeah, he is a killer. And he tells her that right up front. And a lot of what happens between Diana and Matthew as a couple, but also what happens to them individually, is that they both have to really face who they are. And I think that really is all of our journeys wrapped up, you know, in a very simple language. We're all learning to accept who we are as people. I think that it does, you know, what I tell my students when I teach these subjects is that witches are monsters to think with. They're a place where we park our cultural anxieties and our issues, and we play with them. And the stories we tell are as revealing about who we are as a culture as they are about any of the witches who were supposedly, you know, making up stories about.
Mm. We have to talk about one of the non-mythical creatures, or maybe it is a mythical creature, but this is a non-living one. It's a book at the center of the trilogy, the Ashmole 782, which is a book that Diana finds at the start of the trilogy. It's filled with images of alchemical drawings, such as on a particular page, there's this chemical wedding of gold and silver. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a book that has been rendered out of your imagination, but you actually have had a similar experience in your work as a historian. You found, is it a lost manuscript or two?
I found two copies of the same manuscript. I was looking for something else entirely. It was completely accidental. And I looked, and a book I had been looking for actually for years, I suddenly looked at the top of a catalog page at the Bodleian Library in Oxford, and there was a word, Alderaya. And I had been looking for something called Alderaya or the Book of Soiga for 3.5 years when I was writing my dissertation and could not find it. And there it was. The minute I stopped looking for it, it turned up. And it was a book that was owned by Queen Elizabeth I's court astrologer, a man named John Dee. And it was supposed to carry within it, we thought, all of the secrets about why he was so interested in magic and talking with angels through a crystal ball. And of course, when we actually opened it, it didn't contain anything like that at all. But yes, and I should say about Ashmole 782, Ashmole 782 was another book that I called up and wanted to look at the Bodleian Library. And when I put in my request for it, it came back as lost.
Uh-huh.
So Ashmole 782 is a real lost manuscript at the Bodleian Library. I've just imagined what maybe might be in it.
And I love the fact that the initial discovery happened at the Bodleian. I mean, what a perfect place to launch anyone on an adventure. Exactly.
Yeah. As someone who's worked there, if you're going to find a vampire in Oxford, the Bodleian's a good place to look.
Deborah Harkness, congratulations on the end of the trilogy, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a really lovely afternoon. Thanks.
The bioscience world is all abuzz about a new gene slicing method, but it is again raising questions about whether humans should tinker with their own gene pool. One of the pioneers of this new technology spoke recently at Harvard Medical School, and Carrie Goldberg from Here and Now, contributor WBUR, was there.
The atmosphere in the Harvard Medical School auditorium was electric. An audience of more than 300 jammed the hall to overflowing, humming with anticipation, for quite a technical talk by a visiting scientist, Jennifer Doudna of Berkeley. Near the front sat the medical school's dean, Jeffrey Flyer.
I don't believe in my years at Harvard Medical School I have ever seen a crowd of this magnitude for a lecture of this kind.
What's the draw?
The draw is this is one of the most exciting topics in the scene of biology today.
That exciting topic is a revolutionary new method to edit DNA that has spread to thousands of labs around the world just in the last couple of years. It's known by the acronym CRISPR for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Palindromic Repeats. It acts as a sort of molecular scissors that can be easily targeted to cut and modify specific genes. CRISPR occurs naturally in bacteria, but scientists are now learning to harness its power to alter DNA for research across the board, cancer, HIV, brain disease, even to make better potatoes. It looks particularly promising for diseases that hinge on just one gene, like sickle cell anemia or cystic fibrosis.
The name definitely, it's a bit jargony, but it is actually an incredibly easy tool to use to manipulate DNA.
Katrine Bosley is the CEO of Editas Medicine, a Cambridge, Massachusetts biotech company founded by leading CRISPR scientists to develop treatments for genetic diseases.
Part of the reason there's this incredible excitement in the scientific community is that as many people have picked it up and tried it, it's worked for them. I've had scientists say to me, quote unquote, I tried it and my first experiment worked. Now, that almost never happens.
Back in the laboratory area of Editas Medicine, scientist Deepak Rayon is using CRISPR to make genetically modified cells and mice. These models, as they're called, are used for studying diseases and looking for possible cures, and they're now far faster and easier to create.
We can think about generating models at a rate of even two or three models in a week, right? We used to think about generating one mouse model in a year. 10 years ago, people would work on making one model for their PhD thesis.
So, sounds great, right? Such a step forward that it's something like going from a manual typewriter to computerized word processing. But CRISPR is also making some people, including some scientists, very nervous. It's raising the prospect of creating designer babies, manipulating genes to bolster intelligence or immunity to disease. Suddenly, a longtime staple of science fiction, from Brave New World to the movie Gattaca, is entering the realm of the possible. The current reality, though, is that making designer babies is still very much science fiction. CRISPR has a long way to go before any parent would ever want to use the technology on a baby because it's clearly not safe. It's not specific enough to hit only the genes you're targeting. It could change others as well. Dr. Keith Jung at Massachusetts General Hospital is working on that targeting problem.
We now know that we can make a change at a desired target, so-called on-target site. But what has been less clear is if we are causing changes elsewhere in the genome at so-called off-target sites. So these would be unintended changes to the DNA.
So CRISPR is still in its early days, but the discussion about using it to alter the human gene pool has already begun in the scientific community, mostly with calls not to cross the line into meddling with human heredity. Though some argue that if and when we can make humanity better, especially by eradicating diseases, maybe we should. The first question, says Boston University bioethicist George Annis, is,
should we ever use this technique on human embryos that are destined to become children? I actually think the answer to that is no.
He argues that the world needs to create a new global body to regulate changes to the human gene pool, maybe called something like the Human Species Protection Agency.
We need, new structures, new oversight, new transparency. The scientists can't do it alone.
As the science of CRISPR keeps forging ahead, Annis and others are saying, we'd better start talking about where we want it to go. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
And today we say goodbye and thanks to two members of our staff. First, to our digital intern, Caroline Santinelli, who is off to hike the Pacific Crest Trail. Caroline, you have been great, but don't bring your iPhone on the hike just to listen to our podcast. It's just going to weigh you down. We're also saying farewell today to our Washington-based producer, Acacia Squires. Acacia is not leaving NPR. She'll be working on the Education Reporting Project. Acacia, you have done great work for us, wrangling correspondents all over the globe and putting up with a lot of time, probably too much, on the other end of our speakerphone. We will miss your ideas, your sense of humor, and your ability to deliver, and we wish you the best of luck. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.